ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 13th of February. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Liberal MPs and senators are set to determine the future of the party today with the leadership showdown planned for later this morning. Many are throwing their support behind Angus Taylor, confident he can defeat current opposition leader Susan Lee. The contest for deputy leader is also wide open. The victors will then have the challenge of setting out an alternative vision to win back support from voters. Political reporter Sarah Tomevska has more.
In the Melbourne seat of Goldstein, it's not hard to find frustrated voters.
Well, I find it very sad that adult people are behaving in such a manner. Just can't you be sensible?
The electorate was the only teal seat returned to the Liberals at the last election.
You're meant to be all on the same party.
The sense of chaos plaguing the party has contributed to a hemorrhaging of support to One Nation in opinion polls. But can a change of leadership turn that around?
Not sure. My heart says Miss Lay. My brain probably says Angus, only because everybody else will be voting for Angus. But is that going to solve the problem?
I think Susan Lee, to me, never ever looked like a leader. And I think that Angus Taylor probably looks more like a leader.
Well, he seems to have the right ideas. He's young, he's bright-eyed, bushy-tailed.
We would like someone who's more proactive, I think.
Back in Parliament, Angus Taylor's supporters are confident he has the numbers after a wave of frontbench resignations yesterday, including from former Susan Lee supporters James McGrath and Dean Smith. Moderate ally Melissa Price admits it's not looking good for the leader.
I think if the spill motion should get up, Then, my sense is that Taylor probably has just got his nose in front.
Though the race for deputy leader is wide open, Dan Tehan, Tim Wilson, Jane Hume and Melissa Price, all potential contenders.
I've got lots more experience than anyone, I think.
Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is no stranger to a leadership challenge. What is the feeling like in these party rooms before a spill?
Well, it's clearly very tense and both sides are trying to shore up their numbers, but they don't have very long to wait.
The looming prospect of knifing the party's first ever female leader does present its own political challenges. Here's Liberal Senator Paul Scar.
Our political opponents will brutally weaponise this.
Malcolm Turnbull says Parliament in general is a difficult place for women.
Look, I think there is an enormous amount of misogyny in politics.
Do you think Susan Lee has had a bad run of things because she is a woman?
Look, I think the answer is probably yes, but having said that, it is a dreadful job being opposition leader. I've done it. I mean, I think 9 months is a very short time, but having said that, the polls are really catastrophic.
But Melissa Price says Susan Lee hasn't been given enough time.
Well, we do need a change, but I think we could have had a change under Susan. So I think the question no one's really answering is, are these once upon a time Liberal voters, they're now One Nation voters, are they ever coming back?
As the right of Australian politics grapples with where to go next.
Sarah Tomevska with that report. And for more on this story, we're joined by 7:30's political editor Jacob Grieber in Canberra. Jacob, just how tight are the numbers looking?
Look, I think it's drifting away from Susan Lee. We saw a series of resignations all day yesterday. That was into double digits, including people who had supported her in the past, like LNP Senator James McGrath. So a real sense of a bit of a levy breaking there. To be honest with you, I wouldn't even be surprised if Taylor wins this comfortably. We'll have to wait and see. We'll know in a few hours, but it's definitely moving against her fast.
Some Liberals are calling this a change or die moment for the party. What do Angus Taylor supporters think he can deliver that Susan Lee couldn't?
Well, it's just someone different is the plea at this point. The numbers have been moving brutally against the Liberal Party. as James Patterson so clearly pointed out, you know, it's a daily loss rate that is unsustainable. They won't exist as a party at the next election if that continues. Now, what Taylor brings is really a traditional sort of liberal, fiscally conservative viewpoint. He is conservative, but the question I think that everyone's got is he's not a tub-thumping populist type conservative. He does have conservative views. He's always been an ally of people like Tony Abbott, but is he the sort of populist right-wing voice that many, many liberals fear or want the Liberal Party to have to be able to pursue someone like Pauline Hanson, who has been cleaning up with disaffected liberals, unhappy with Susan Lee's leadership, and they've gone to One Nation? Is Angus Taylor really that kind of a conservative? We'll find out. That is one of the things his supporters will want him to be.
And another big issue for the Liberal Party is the loss of female and young voters. A lot of commentary about how it looks to dump the first female leader. Do you think who ultimately is elected deputy leader might help in determining the future of this party?
Well, determining the future of the party is a really tough call for me to predict on, but I think there is a real acute awareness inside Taylor's camp and the Liberal Party that he does need to have strong women around him. I think Jane Hume, who's one of the candidates for deputy, her chances and numbers, I'm told, overnight have firmed. She's up against Ted O'Brien and also Dan Tehan. And I think for Angus Taylor to go with one of the blokes would just really reinforce what it is that you're pointing to in your question, which is that this is still a blokes' party and that they've torn down the first female leader after just 9 months. Now, it's more complicated than that because there's actually a lot of women, prominent women in the Liberal Party who've been part of the real push to bring her down, including Jane Hume, including Senator Henderson earlier in the week. So it's complicated. I think a lot of people will feel that she wasn't given enough time. But the overriding sentiment today is that the Liberal Party no longer has time for that. Something has to change. Whether it changes in policy terms, I don't know yet. Taylor hasn't really mapped out how different he'll be. But the one thing you can be sure of in politics, you only really get one shot at making a first impression.
And Jacob, you were talking about Angus Taylor and how he can take on that fight with the right. But where would it leave the party to take on the centre and to try and win back some of those teal seats in the cities?
That is the existential question for the Liberal Party in 2026 and the next few years up to the next election. They have to find a way to reconnect with those voters. You mentioned it. It's women, it's younger voters. And Liberals recognise this. They're under no illusions about that. So is chasing the right flank the way to do that? Many would say no. But did Susan Lee manage to pull that off? It's not clear she did. She did give the Conservatives in the party most of the things they wanted, whether it was on dumping net zero, on re-establishing the coalition, against the loud expressed wishes of quite a few moderates who were saying, no, it's time for a spell apart. Now, Angus Taylor is a coalitionist, and he's unlikely to want to break the coalition up at all. That will be centre to his pitch, to his leadership.
7:30's political editor Jacob Greber in Canberra. Today, Stolen Generation survivors will meet in Parliament House to mark 18 years since the historic national apology was made. But statistics reveal since then, the number of Indigenous children removed from their families has more than doubled. Kimberly Price reports.
Survivors of the Stolen Generation gathered in Parliament House for the long-awaited apology, while children tuned in from around the country for the historic moment.
Today we honour the Indigenous peoples of this land, the oldest continuing cultures in human history. We reflect on their past mistreatment.
Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's apology speech aimed to recognise the past atrocities against the Stolen Generation and their lingering effects, and it gave many hope for a better future.
To the mothers and the fathers, the brothers and the sisters, for the breaking up of families and communities, we say sorry. We today take this first step by acknowledging the past and laying claim to a future that embraces all Australians.
Associate Professor of Social Policy at the University of New South Wales and proud Wiradjuri woman, Dr. BJ Newton, has been researching some of the language used in the apology speeches. In then opposition leader Brendan Nelson's subsequent speech, she believes harmful terms were used.
Some of the language that he uses is about white superiority and needing to save children from squalor.
Others were placed with white families, whose kindness motivated them to the belief that rescued children deserved a better life. It's reasonably argued that removal from squalor led to better lives.
That's not apologising.
18 years on, BJ Newton believes not much has changed from Dr. Rudd's promise to build a future for all Australians.
The apology speech wasn't the beginning of a new era of things improving for Aboriginal children and families in child protection systems.
At the time of the apology, more than 9,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children lived in out-of-home care. While the national apology speech aimed to ensure the injustices of the stolen generation must never, never happen again, as of June 2024, almost 20,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children remain in out-of-home care. And that number doesn't include those on guardianship orders.
Oh, look, I'm an Aboriginal person. It's always distressing because those numbers are our families. They're our children.
Catherine Little is the CEO of SNAKE National Voice for Our Children. She believes there's been a lack in government policy working to reunite families and keep them together.
Today, what we're working with is a system that was built to remove children. We still see every election cycle our children picked up and bounced around like a football, just kicked from pillar to post. And we hear all the words and the commitments to keeping children safe, and yet those numbers keep escalating.
Catherine Little believes the creation of the National Commissioner for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People will lead to greater government accountability, but she urges for more funding to support in-home family outcomes.
Children thrive and families thrive when they have the supports that they need.
In a statement to AM, a spokesperson for the Minister of Social Services, Tanya Plibersek, says the rates of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children in out-of-home care are unacceptable, and reaffirmed the government's almost $130 million investment in community-led programs to build strong and safe families.
Kimberly Price reporting, and today the federal government has announced $87 million over 4 years to support survivors of the stolen generations. A New Zealand court will hear arguments against the Christchurch terrorist Brenton Tarrant's bid to have his guilty plea vacated. The Australian gunman says he was not of sound mind when he first made that guilty plea following the March 2019 massacre at two mosques. The submissions from Crown lawyers will take up the final day of an extraordinary week-long hearing. Barbara Miller has been at the court and filed this report.
It occurs, silence will stand.
Brenton Tarrant's application to vacate his guilty pleas is being heard in Wellington. In a Christchurch courtroom, families of the 51 people he shot dead at two mosques there are following via a delayed recording. And in Auckland, the prisoner participates from the high security facility where he's serving a life sentence. New Zealand's three largest cities caught up in this extraordinary legal matter. At the start of the week, the 35-year-old Australian told the court harsh prison conditions had left him unable to make rational decisions when in March 2020 he pleaded guilty to the massacre. Such are the concerns about giving him a platform that only the first few minutes of his three-hour appearance was cleared for broadcast.
You were engaged, that you participated in the legal meetings that you had. Would you agree with that?
Sure.
Alexander Gillespie is a professor of law at Waikato University.
I think Anders Breivik in Norway utilised this kind of platform in the past, and I think New Zealand has learnt from that by making sure that there's a much tighter control over the media and the reporting of the incidents.
Tarrant's lawyers, whose voices are distorted to protect their identity, told the court everyone has a right to minimum standards.
Even Mr. Tarrant.
who has been described as the most reviled person in New Zealand.
Sitting in to this hearing, listening to legal arguments about the right to appeal, when in the same manner the right of life of my brother and 50 others were taken away, it just does not sit very well with me.
That's Aya Alomari, whose brother Hussein was killed in the attack. Whatever the outcome of this week's hearing, it's unlikely to be Tarrant's last day in court. Alexander Gillespie.
Unfortunately, it could be one of a sequence of times when the Christchurch person isn't trying to get platforms for himself.
And what makes you so sure that that's what we're seeing here?
It's a common pattern often with those who are convicted of extremist crimes to try to get exposure, both for notoriety and to continue the pain that they inflict upon others.
The hearing is before a panel of three judges. Their decision might not be handed down for a couple of months. It'll be an anxious wait for Aya and for all those whose lives were forever changed by a heinous act on March the 15th, 2019. This is Barbara Miller in Wellington reporting for AM.
Getting to school each day can be a challenge for any student, but spare a thought for those who live far, far away from the classroom. There's about 4,000 kids from isolated communities receiving an allowance from the federal government to help them board away from home. Many families say this support is critical, but the costs keep rising. Kath Sullivan has this story.
We're going.
It's just taken us all day to pack.
Getting the kids back to school this year has taken New South Wales mum Prue Ritchie a bit of time.
We are loaded.
Bye.
It's goodbye to home.
For her daughters, Ali and Georgie, it's 850 kilometres from home outside of Bourke to the boarding house in Sydney.
I think around 10 hours, maybe 10 and a half. Like, it's a pretty long drive.
Without a school bus service near home, Prue Ritchie says boarding in Sydney made sense.
My family live down here. For us, choosing Sydney was all about choosing the support that we'd have around the children.
Is it hard?
Yeah, it's really hard. So, yep.
It's also expensive.
So boarding can range anywhere from about probably $15,000 to about $50,000 for boarders.
Richard Stokes runs the Australian Boarding Schools Association, which provides training and support for staff working in more than 200 boarding houses around Australia. He says changing expectations and legal requirements mean boarding fees are on the up.
I think they've gone up faster than inflation, but for logical reasons. If I look back to my early days in boarding, I was a 19-year-old looking after 100 boys all by myself. And nowadays, no parent nor no school would let that happen. So obviously with more people working, there are higher wages, and so therefore the fees go up as well.
In the 1970s, the Whitlam government announced support to help kids from isolated communities get to school. Each year it goes up with CPI, and today the basic boarding allowance is set at about $10,500 per student. But families receiving the allowance say it's not keeping pace with boarding fees. To be eligible, the family home must be at least 56 kilometres from the nearest government school, or at least 4.5 kilometres from transport. Students who miss school for 20 days a year due to circumstances such as bad weather are also eligible.
When you look at the majority of kids who are eligible for the ARC, they are in fact living in small towns, children of working people who might be shearers, cooks, whatever, salary earners, and they cannot afford to send their kids to boarding school.
Louise Martin is federal president of the Isolated Children's Parents Association and is calling for a one-off $24 million boost to the allowance so payments would reflect about 55% of the average boarding fee. She also wants to see it tied to a sub-education index rather than CPI.
Honestly, I'm tired of coming to Canberra and asking for this. It's such an essential thing. We are talking about 4,000 students across the nation.
The ICPA says it hasn't had an in-person meeting with the minister responsible for the allowance in 10 years. That includes the current Social Services Minister, Tanya Plibersek, who took up the role last year. Her office says the government remains firmly committed to supporting families when attending a local school isn't an option.
Kath Sullivan with that story. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump was his one-time friend, and his name appears countless times in the Epstein files. But it's the British leader who's on very shaky ground, even though he's not even named in the documents. Today, Professor of Politics at Deakin Uni, Simon Tormey, on how Keir Starmer became so deeply embroiled in the controversy. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.